Yeah, so I have been a fellow here since, well, actually since last summer, and it's about to end, unfortunately, and most of my work actually has been focusing here at the Digital Natives Project, and my interest in the Digital Natives was really at the time gaming and how younger kids actually create content for games and so on. What I'm going to talk about today, as you can see, is the designing for mod development, which I will introduce right now. What I'm going to talk about a little bit. My interest has always been user creativity, and by that I mean really online, how users write stories on their interest in movies, or how they are blogging, how they use MySpace and so forth. But my real interest was really how the extent of how users participate in firm hosted environments, because we've heard a lot about commons-based kind of communities like Wiki and so forth. But for a while we had companies like, as you all know, in the film and music industries, when all these peer-to-peer networks came about, that people or these kinds of industries started suing, more or less, rather than come up with innovative concepts of how to invite and work with the kind of downloaders and users of their music and digital downloads. So, and lots of academic studies have been focusing on all these implications for business, or thinking about participatory culture or convergence culture. We have seen books like Wikinomics. We've actually seen our own Yochai Benckler's work on the wealth of networks. And it's all very much, I mean, it's all true what these people write, but a lot of times it's very utopian from lots of ways. And not a whole lot of empirical research has been conducted in what actually is happening on these firm-hosted platforms. Because what has happened is that companies, and in different sectors, so it's not only in the entertainment and media software industries, but also tech companies, clothing, fashion companies, and so on, that have started ways, or looking for new ways to reconnect with their clientele, with the customer base. So rather than having the negative and trying to constrain user participation, they started inviting users to come and play with their brand in different fashions. So we've seen a few years ago, we saw BMW, the ad for game movies. We've seen a lot of brands playing with gaming formats, with movie formats, with music. You know, we've seen MTV, Adidas, and you name it. Lots of companies have been trying to venture in reconnecting with their user base. So, and I say that's called like an imperative of production. So we no longer have only the firm side that comes with the product. But they say, well, we invite you to play and toy and tinker with whatever our product is on our platform. So what I want to talk today, or zoom in today on, is actually on the games and gaming industries, and focus on a really straightforward way of user participation, which is mod development. So those are people that usually like to play games, not all of them, but who like to make changes to those games. And they can be very minor changes by adding maps and skins, and I will give you some examples, to really total conversion mods, where a game is completely new and it's based on the technology, on the source engine of the original game that has been opened up by the software developer firm. My interest is therefore the professionalization of user participation, and on top of that is what I'm really interested in is in the underlying dynamics of what this means for a company, what this means for strategies, what this means for competition, what this means for how a company can learn from what users actually do, which goes beyond simple or mere feedback mechanisms. And let's say I have quite a critical approach to what's going on, as you will see in my empirical data. So I have, over the past 2 years, I think, by now, I've worked with Valve, which is a software developer located in Seattle. They are really their work is mostly first-person shooters, like Counter-Strike, Half-Life, recently Portal, and they work on really cool stuff. They're a private company, so there's only so much information available or that they're willing to share. But I must say, they have been really great in providing me with information, interviews, and so on. The second company that I've been working on with is Linden Lab, based in San Francisco, the makers of Second Life, which I'm sure most people have heard of as well. Then I have worked with Nintendo DS and THQ as a combination, because I've been working on a game called Drawn to Life, which is a game for the Nintendo DS for really young kids, like 7 years, more or less, 7 years old, and where they also get the tools and they really have to create their own gameplay by making drawings into that game. So I've been working with those companies. And then the last one is Cartoon Networks with Fusion Fall, which is going to launch in spring 2008, hopefully. So I cannot really say anything about that, actually. But that is also part of the research. So we have, and Fusion Fall is actually Cartoon Network brand. So this is these are all companies that I've looked at and that have really been in different levels of openness, have invited users to play with creating content or with the source engine and so on. So first, I will actually focus mostly on Valve and Linden Labs, because it's very straightforward, the kind of things that they do. So I want to show a few YouTube videos. To show you what game modders do. So these are made by modders, by gamers who like to create stuff. Sorry, I have to wait a few seconds before everything opens up. The first one, do we have sound and stuff?
Yep.
Okay. So this is created by a German group of actually gamers who really like Half-Life. And Half-Life is one of the most famous, well-known brands and games made by Valve. And basically, if you've never played Half-Life, this little machinima actually tells you what Half-Life is all about. It's about Morgan Freeman, who actually tries to rescue all kinds of things, and he works in a laboratory. But you can really tell the game story in 60 minutes. So that's what they've done. So that's one way of actually playing with the brand. Then this is based on a Simpsons, which you all know, television series, and Counter-Strike. So there's a map created in Counter-Strike. And he dies a lot. Well, I guess you get the idea. So you see, it's not really that advanced yet. You can see through Homer Simpson, and sometimes he goes underground with no real, there's no, the physics are not really great. But this is what people create. I will show you some more. Then there is Portal. Portal is a game that last year came out, and here gamers have they took two games of Valve, and they took Portal and Counter-Strike, and they mixed that into one. Yeah, so people get pretty advanced. That's the original Portal, which I will show you. This is actually a little trailer made by Valve, so you can get an idea of what.
There's a hole in the sky through which things can fly. At the Enrichment Center,
Well, that's what Portal is all about, and I think you saw those big holes that were made, and what those modders did in the previous video was that they put that in the Counter-Strike map. Yes. Yes. It's actually of the Source engine, but it's a very it's not even that complex, actually. I want to say it's very complex, but it's not. Valve, may I ask who plays games here at all and knows anything about modifications? Maybe I should have started that with that. Yes. Just a little. Yeah. Well, when a game is being developed, there's an engine, like a big, whole underworld of technology that the developer comes up with in order to create games. And you need animators, designers, programmers, and so on. It's a very complex technology. Valve, I'm not going into the whole history of Valve, but Valve started out with another developer's engine, and they rebuilt that into their own Source developer's kit that they have now, so it's called the Source SDK. And based on that, every game that they develop in-house, they use that kind of technology for. So Half-Life, Portal, Team Fortress, Day of Defeat, and all their other games are based on this source engine. And what that means is that Portal, the story behind Portal is that there were a few kids, well, not kids, there were students at DigiPen in Seattle, trying to get a degree in computer programming and games development. And for their end of year project, they came up with this idea of Portal, and they created one small level in order to pass. Valve is really interested in always looking around what's going on in different communities to hire new employees, obviously. And they were really interested in this group of students. So they hired them before they were actually got their degree. But because of IP issues, Portal had to be rebuilt all the way on the source engine of Valve. They could not take that intellectual property from DigiPen University and just use that. So basically, all the games are in a way mods of the other games that that Valve makes. So there's different levels of modification going on that are not necessarily across firm boundaries. So Valve, as a developer, also mods in a way parts of their own engine in order to create new games. Yes.
The original art within Counter-Strike, or was it that the university where the students were doing
university
this work?
University, that's their IP.
That IP based on
exactly.
The students
doing. Yes. They cannot take it with them. Yeah.
So the university got nothing out of it?
No. Well,
prestige,
I guess, yes.
A remarkably weak negotiating position for them, right? I mean, you know, essentially you've got these kids hired by the company that's got the engine.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. No, it's fascinating, but I get into that if I have time later on in IP issues that are involved in this whole mod process. So these are examples of Valve. Linden Lab. Second Life is obviously a completely different kind of environment than the games that I just showed. Actually, a lot of people, including myself, would say Second Life is not a game, but it's a 3D world environment. And I actually call it, in my research, a 3D platform. And I really approach Second Life as a software, as a tool for communication purposes. And that could be any kind of communication, from just people talking and socializing to businesses using it as a tool. Again, we go back to YouTube. YouTube is great. This is a griefing attack in Second Life. Oh no.
The great Greekzilla leaving a blazing trail of terror to downtown Second Life.
So again, another example of what people can do in Second Life. So this is based on someone who created Griefzilla, based obviously on Godzilla, King Kong, and other creatures, and created a machinima out of it. Then the next one is a griefing attack. So basically someone tried to hack and cheat within Second Life by blocking anything other avatars could do in a particular time. So all those little cubes basically block or prevent people from functioning. There will come lots more. Yes. It's a whole group, actually. It's a team. A team of griefers. Yes. Well, so this goes on. It's an attack where, I mean, there's different types of attacks, obviously. There's people who really are mean. I mean, it's always really annoying for the avatars, obviously, that are involved. But some of them are really, like this one tries to make people aware of racism and so on, which I'm not saying that that's a, but let's say it's a different kind of thing. I was, for instance, griefed at some point in a meeting with Lindenlab in the world where we're talking about open sourcing Second Life, and then everything, suddenly all avatars, including myself, were saying Heil Hitler, and there was nothing you could do. I couldn't log out. I mean, I really had to turn on my computer in order to get back to, well, normal, and then obviously Second Life is down for a few hours. And then there, this is another type of mod. This is a guy who changed the way you look in Second Life, because normally you just see your avatar moving, and this is a first look. So this is almost like a first-person shooter, actually. He only wears glasses, so it's kind of like a weird way of looking at it. Oh, and they're just talking, so it's not really... I think it would be better if you would not be wearing glasses, but... and this is what voice sounds like in Second Life if you talk. Yeah, about buying beds. So these are examples of modification, so what people can do. So user participation can really vary from just, you know, create your avatar or just play a game and interact with the environments to really creating machinimas, to create real content, make iterations, modifications of skins, but even creating whole new games. And even beyond that, there's even people who try to reverse engineer the engines and other parts of the technology, which is happening both in case of Valve and in case of Lindenlab. Lindenlab is actually really happy with it. Valve is not as happy with it for reasons, obviously, of IP and licensing, but I will get to that. So there's different, lots and lots of different ways what modifications are and can be. So in my research, what I've called this like a playground. So to me, modding is the interest. And what I was interested in is the dynamics or the interdependent relationships of the developer firm on the one hand and the mod developers on the other hand. Although that sounds like they're separated, but in my research, I will show that they're not. It's all part of one big community or networks of where people are related, where both firm and mod developers know as much or nothing about how they have to move forward with the technologies. They learn from each other, or sometimes they fail to learn from each other. And sometimes they sue each other, sometimes they collaborate. It's a very, very gray area of what's going on in these sorts of mod communities or modification culture, so you will. So I divided my research up when I started looking at these firm-hosted communities. So I started looking at the design capabilities, and the design capabilities is really simple, is what, who are the people that are doing this? So what does the game, the modder, who plays Valve games, who is in Second Life? So I kind of look at the kind of the history of who's there, the types of memberships, but also what they create, so the extent of innovation. So is it just like in Second Life merely just content creation, or do people not even create but buy houses from other people? Or so I looked at those kinds of things. Then the second thing I looked at is the design space. And by the design space, I really mean the environment or the platform that's provided by the company. So I looked at the functionalities. And by the functionalities, I mean different types of spaces where users can interact with. So I really looked at the toolkits, the role of the toolkits that people have, the kinds of so ways of how users can interact with the space. So whether that's the game space or whether that's the 3D Second Life type of space. And there's different levels, as I will show later on. And then one step beyond that, I looked at the perception that the software developer firm has about these gamers and modders, because a lot of times it's really great to say that, hey, here's our source engine and here is documentation, or this is Second Life and these are the tools and just have fun and play with it. But obviously there's lots of terms of services and there's lots of other IP issues involved, and licensing strategies and so on. So based on studying those kinds of parts of the firm and what they put out there, so the tools and the legal side of things is what falls under the design space, because it says a lot about the transferability, how if you develop a mod, how you can put it out there for other people again to use. Yeah.
Where did you find the modders work?
That's the next slide.
Oh, okay.
I will tell you, well, as far as I think. Yeah. And the third part that I looked at of the research is learning by design. And by that I mean not learning in terms of educational learning, but company learning. So I looked at mainly how, on what levels the software developer tries to interact, and not by just obviously putting out the game, but communication means. So I looked at the forums, wikis, blogs, anything that's available in documentation for these people to interact. And I looked at the relational dynamics. So I did a huge, I had a huge database with over 6 million posts and information and bug tracker information and so on. And I looked at how, in what way Linden Lab or Valve is connected to their user base, and I looked at frequencies and topical involvement and social involvement. And based on that, I looked at how agenda is set within further development of the game, or in the other case, the Second Life platform. So how basically the company can learn from user interactions. What I did is I conducted interviews in all the companies, so in Valve, Linden Lab, Nintendo, and so on. And I also put out surveys on the site of the user base. So in Valve's case, that meant that on their Steam platform, that's their main way to sell games. I put announcements on the forums with the survey, and whoever wanted to participate could. And what I found is that people like to play games for different reasons, obviously. And the one of the main reasons, as you can hopefully see, is that it's for reducing stress is a very important appeal factor for gamers to play. I have to say that the gamers of Valve were, on average, they were between 15 and 20 years old. So they have a different, the ones of Second Life were on average 34 years old. So it's a different type of person that took these surveys. So reducing stress, the themes and plots, so the narration is really important, the graphics is, are really important, exploring different worlds, social interactions, and yeah, well, innovation and so on. But so it's really about the world, the narration, and how cool it looks. I obviously started also asking questions about who plays mods, and I had like 136 people after cleaning up the whole survey base. So 55% plays mods, 23% actually makes modifications, and of those 23%, half of it makes total conversion modifications, which is pretty advanced. It's not an easy thing to do. 22% makes or creates maps. Then there's people who make minor changes like textures and so on, and sounds, which is 90%, and miscellaneous was more the on the periphery that they were contributing to other people's advanced skills by, for instance, creating the website and so on. The reasons why people like to mod were curiosity, boredom, and as you can see, 34% people were sort of wanted to have new experiences. They were kind of fed up with what was out there, what was in the game, and they really wanted to add something to that. There is, although most mods are put out there for free and distributed for free, a lot of times because they have to. Like, if you mod one of Valve's games, it's fine as long as you're not getting any money out of it. However, if mod communities would actually ask money for a mod, 42% is actually willing to pay for a mod. So that's is opportunities, or who knows. Then this is data for Valve, Second Life, I'm sorry. The reasons why people are in Second Life is, again, social interactions. But what was really important is also the tool. So they like to build script, texture, they find it innovative. It was not as much about trying to be someone else, which a lot of times you see in other research that people like to, like in massively multiplayer online role-playing games, that there's a huge factor of people like to pretend to be someone else. And that was here not that much of a case. At the time of the survey, that was like 2 months after Linolab open sourced part of the viewer source code, of the client code. So there's not a very much of a large interest yet here in open source, because it was at the time pretty new and people didn't really know yet what to do. So when Linolab did open source, it attracted newer people, more advanced people later on, which are not really included at the time of the survey. I did a cluster analysis of the type of people based on communication and communication behavior and participation behavior of Second Life users. So I focused on what, how many hours they spend in the world, what tools, whether people like to build or script or texture or do all of those things, and based on that I came up with these categories of people. It's not really that interesting to tell you who exactly everybody is, but the power reser, which is 9%, is really the hardcore type of Second Life membership type, and those are the most advanced type of users. So these are really the people who actually do not spend a whole lot of time in world, but they do spend a lot of time working on the technology in order to improve the platform. These are also the people that are the opinion leaders, who are usually the ones who do not post a lot or initiate posts a lot on the forums or make contributions to the wiki. It's usually the people who answer other people's questions. Then the largest group is obviously the newbies, and these are people that are really operating on the margins. If you would have like a circle, they would really be on the outskirts of it. They barely spend any time in the world, and they haven't really played with anything, they haven't really used any tools, and most of them were not really even sure if they would want to be in Second Life. So that was very fascinating. I have more information on my website, so if you're interested to read more about this you can. So then I looked more down into the design space itself. So the second level, so I just described the design capabilities of different people. As you can see, hopefully, is the tools are really important. Most people like to build in Second Life, which is fairly easy to do. Texturing is usually, and building go hand in hand most of the time. Scripting is a little bit, is actually far more advanced because you need to know the Linux scripting language, and you need to really invest some time in order to know what to do. It's really programming, and as it is their own scripting language, you really have to learn it when you upon joining Second Life. Then there's 2%, very small percentage of people who open source the client code, so the viewer, and 1% is actually on functioning on the macro level, which is really the underlying technology of Second Life. So not the interface, which is the viewer, but really the underlying server side, which up till now actually is still closed. It's not open sourced, but there's quite a lot of groups, and especially the Liberation Second Life and OpenSim, that have worked on all of this stuff with some semi-approval from LinenLab, and try to improve the underworld technology of Second Life in order to be able to open source the server side later on. At least that's what LinenLab says that they want to do in the future. So who knows? Which would be helpful, because if people can run their own servers at some point, it would help in terms of interoperability issues. You would get rid of governance issues, because right now everything you do depends on LinenLab. It all depends on what, on the tools that they provide you with. It's the kind of terms of services and so on. I've mentioned that below. The terms of services and is what you have to sign or agree with once you open up Second Life. And although they've put themselves out there in the news as that you own the IP rights, technically you do. But if you really start looking at it, you don't own anything. Because the moment you want to go or move to another platform, your content is still in Second Life. So you cannot really take it with you, because it's Second Life property and it doesn't work with other worlds, at least not yet. You also sign your rights away that you may own your own IP, but LinenLab can use it all the time, whenever they want to. Even though you may already be gone as a user, they can still use it. It's still up in the world, and it will be on their servers as long as they let it on there or leave it on there. So basically, there's lots of issues with these with their terms of service. And actually, Melanie and I are trying to write a paper about that. Then on the open source level of open sourcing the viewer, there's obviously a different type of contract. But even there, we have similar problems. So again, you may use particular parts, and but it has to be non-commercial. You cannot, whereas LinenLab can use contributions made by mod developers and license that to other companies. But the mod developer does not have such rights. They can use it, but never make it profitable, and so on. So there's lots of issues with their type of legal contracts. Yes. Yeah, the viewer is made in, yes. Yes. The next step that I looked at, this is the learning by design part, which is the mastery and leadership. So I looked at how, I conducted a factor analysis and looked at how LinenLab or Linden's relate to different types of Second Life users. And it's kind of small. But what I in the graph that's below, you can see a few big and smaller sizes, and this is based on how people communicate. So this is based on 1.5 million forum posts, and I looked at how many people started or initiated posts, and I looked at how many comments they received, and I looked at how often people self-commented on this. So I did this whole analysis, and this is just one little part of it. That shows you that there's a few people that are very opinionated and also receive quite a lot of comments. Based on that, I also started looking at what they're actually writing about, because there's obviously a lot of noise in communications, especially in forums. People are mean and nasty most of the times, and they complain a lot. But so I had to create a distinction, basically, what people were actually, how often they were posting, and versus what the actual content was of their conversations. So based on that, I could come up with a framework to look at mastery and leadership issues, like how people user-to-user learning can take place and how user-to-firm learning can take place. Now we come to the core of the research, basically, is that in modification communities, you see a new type of entrepreneurship. I would almost call it serial entrepreneurship, because there's the developer firm hires a lot of people from the mod communities, while at the same time the developer community itself start hiring people, and not all the time based on profit or money. A lot of times people just start out because they, you know, as a group of people that are very passionate about creating new games or create content or and so on. But what happens is that the developer firm benefits a great deal from those efforts, and whether that's on different levels. Let's say Valve is really interested in these mod groups because it extends their shelf life of a lot of their games. If they really like one of their mods, they will put it also on their Steam network. So distribution, it attracts new people as well. And because of these, like if you want to play one of those mod games, you need to also have the original game itself. So you would actually have to buy the Valve game as well in order to play the mod. So there's all kinds of benefits for companies to actually stimulate and motivate these sort of efforts. However, at some point, there's an interesting effect going on, that the developer firm starts competing with the mod community, only in very rare cases, but it does happen. And we do not see that as much at Valve, but we see that a lot with Second Life, because I guess a lot of people know that you can make money in Second Life. And I'm not saying, you know, that people make a lot of money, but some people really do, and some people can actually live off the money that they earn. But interestingly, if you look at the organization of a developer firm and the organization of mod teams, and regardless of whether they're modders of first-person shooters like Valve or whether they're in Second Life and working on the content level or even on the level of open sourcing Second Life, people tend to work in teams, and they start to organize themselves in very similar ways to the developer firm. So they start working in, they have the designers, they have the animators, they have the programmers, they sometimes even have a manager, which in a lot of cases Valve doesn't even have. So it's very fascinating to see how teams become businesses and how these relational dynamics, what this actually means for thinking about user participation, because it becomes this mix of commercialization and innovation leads to this whole new way of thinking about entrepreneurship, which says a lot about, we can link that back to theoretical concepts of participation, of user innovation, learning, like knowledge management, Eric von Hippel's user innovation, and so on. So this whole idea of production and consumption, this whole separation, doesn't really work in this situation anymore. What I try to do with my lovely circles is that on the left side you see users or mod developers who have been quite active. Well, only the ones that are a little bit bigger in terms of being in touch with software developers about exchanging code and so on. As you see on the right side is that the very, very big circle that's unassigned, which basically means that the firm gets so much feedback but has too little sources or resources to actually be able to learn from what users contribute because they have no way to integrate what's coming their way, which causes frustration actually on the side of the user base, which has consequences or implications again for the firm because a lot of people just leave. And I've seen that a lot in Second Life. So this is one issue of the whole inviting people to participate or play with your product. So there's definitely problems with the division of labor issue, competition, efficiency, and so on, but that's a little bit too much to go into right now. So this is a model developed last Sunday. Really excited about it. This is basically the conclusion of my research. What's going on is that, yes, there's different levels of different types of people working on different levels of modification. So I made a distinction between on the micro level, meso level, macro level. But what's interesting is that these people barely ever communicate with each other. So they stay in their own community. There are lead users among them. And sometimes those people may talk to one another, but it's a very centripetal effect, which causes, which may be negative for firm learning and user learning, because it's hard for people to move from one level of skill set and knowledge set about game modifications to move on to a more advanced level and to learn from other people and to learn from the firm. So you see more that there's like different networks of different people that are surrounding like a particular practice within the mod environment, but they don't really connect with each other, and that's very very interesting for how we think about collaboration and participation as it means that maybe people do not really collaborate a whole lot beyond their boundaries, which may actually constrain or limit innovation. So my takeaway for this is that in my research, mod development, looking at it from a lead user or user innovation perspective, is that it's not unimodal because there's different types of mod developers and with different sets of lead usership. So it's not like what you see in other sectors a lot of times, that there is a particular group surrounding one particular product that's the lead user. Here you have different types of lead user and makes it a very interesting model for complex interaction and complex learning. Build on this is the knowledge that's being provided among each other, among the whole community. So regardless of whether you're a mod developer or that you work on the side of the software developer, is that the knowledge is a derivative. And that's a good thing in a lot of ways, because if there's too much knowledge, people won't learn anymore because there's too much. On the other hand, and basically this knowledge needs to be validated by the rest of the community, whether things work or not, whether scripts or code are working, whether, you know, beta test, feedback loops, it's all part of a multiple process of users like vouching for each other whether things work or not. The thing is then, up to a certain level, this really works out, but then there's an inverted U-shape where it stops, where people no longer participate, where people no longer can innovate, and which I actually work on right now to call it reverse participation. And it's not that I want to be negative and say that it's not great that companies invite people to play and participate and engage with the product, But right now, it's still very much structured. It's still very much confined to the firm's provided space, the provided tools, the provided legal contracts. So mod culture can be evolutionary, but not really it cannot really cause a revolution of any kind. And based on that, lots of these software developers are open. Sometimes they're so very much open that they no longer can oversee what's going on, and they lose any kind of sense of control, and they start failing to see and sift through what the feedback is from the community. And this causes this is causing problems for thinking about the business models and the type of firm learning that can take place in a community like this. So these are just a few implications based on my empirical findings over the past 2 years. And I would like to invite you to give me lots of feedback or questions and so on. Thank you. Not per se. I linked it to the type of people that are in there. So I linked it to specific capabilities that people have. And yeah. Yes. Open source in itself. Well, I guess it kind of depends, actually. How would you?
Well, I was thinking you've got. The way what you're describing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is what happens, or a set of things that happen in a set of closed and siloed environments that are basically commercial.
Yeah.
They vary a great deal, which is one of the things that makes it not being mobile. But it seems to me in open source and the free software development, there are real commonalities there that make it kind of mobile. I never thought of it that way before. I'm thinking right now, looking at your work.
Yeah, yeah.
Commercial sphere, you get multimodal ways of working, whereas it's kind of a little bit more uniform and predictable, mostly because it's under the control of the participant. The participant's kind of the center of things in some ways. I mean, there's a project that's a center, but participation is voluntary. Probably get a lot of the same participation, fallout stuff, but it's almost entirely a meritocracy in every case.
Yeah.
And the meritocracy is based on whether or not the code works or not. But here you've got other imperatives that are commercial, that are hierarchical. They differ from one to the other, but there's a difference in kind between all of that and open source code development. So
yeah. That's a good thought. I will think about that to take, because obviously open source is part of what I'm looking at the same time as well,
yeah.
Which does not strictly fall under any of the software developers. Because I look at the organization of different types of groups, so yeah.
It's an interesting thing, just sort of a side note, because what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years with open source development is that on the one hand, it's been much more corporatized, but on the other hand, the nature of the corporatization is one of not controlling what the programmers do. There's a lot of trust to the programmers that they're going to do the right thing. You hire them because they're good and you hope the right thing happens.
Yes.
And that's very different than what you have here, I think.
Well, not necessarily the open source side of it, actually, but what's going on the content level, very much still. But I believe that this is a phase that we need to go through in order to let it all go. Mm-hmm. In sense of user participation. I believe that we have to have this weird sense of participation, or that's still very relatively confined or constrained. And I think it will, we move to a next, I think we just, yeah, I think there's more and more firms moving towards opening up that as well. But in the end, they still need to make money. So they're really trying to figure out ways of opening it up as much as possible. And even at some point, let go of. And I think if I look at the gaming, in the gaming industry, if you look at user participation or modification culture, then you can really see this time or frame, actually, or line, where you go from first-person shooters, where you can do a lot, but you're very confined with what you can do with the end result. And then you have the massively multiplayer online role-playing games that are pretty open, because in Worlds you can do lots of stuff, but then again, you're still dealing with the contractual stuff. And then you have Second Life, which is really like an odd thing in comparison to the rest. You can do like a lot. And there's obviously not only innovation in terms of technology, but also just the way it's been used. And I guess then you kind of have the web. It has this in very interesting line of openness, or a sense of openness, and sometimes it has a very closed meaning to it. But I believe that we if I look at the games industry at least, I see that a lot of companies move towards trying to become more and more open and finding ways to let it go and have people run their own companies or yeah, to have a different type of thing. I think Ethan is first.
What percentage of people at a company like Valve are or were modders?
A lot, especially Valve.
So yeah. One of the things that I wonder in all of this is whether part of the analysis has to be people who are doing this essentially because they're auditioning. That this seems to be one of the sort of clear pathways into the game industry. There's clearly some enormous population of people who see themselves as future video game designers.
Yes.
I'm wondering if another way to analyze this, particularly on that sort of U-shaped curve that you're talking about, is almost sort of a professional versus fun side of it.
Yes.
People who are doing
this
because it's an easy, curious thing to play with, but then a certain point at which people cross over and essentially at that point are putting out their audition tapes in one fashion.
Oh, you're absolutely right. In my Valve data, it was, well, I think it was about 10% of the gamers or modders that would like to have a job in the gaming industry. Yeah. And that was one of the reasons why they would be modding. Yeah. And Second Life is more on a personal, individual level because they just want to be their own little entity of company. So it's not to work at Lina Lab or anything. Well,
money is currently
absolutely
wrapped up in, you know, the gaming industry versus the rather vague promises of Lina Lab about the burgeoning Second Life economy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The analogy that kept occurring to me was that the modders at that level are basically the same as script writers who were working on spec, and that you, and that the sort of brutal economics of both the film industry and the games industry, you have huge amounts of money, but you have that are produced when you get these great products produced by a tiny number of the many, many, many people putting in many, 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 many hours. So I think obviously there's a little more direct fun element for modders, but at the same time, there is also this something that could be seen as verging on exploitation just because of the way that the economic reality of the
right now,
industry
absolutely.
Is.
That's a good one. Yes.
Yeah, I wonder, to kind of switch gears, but in a similar vein, how much of the modifications you found had political concerns, in that, in a totally different perspective, I know that a lot of modifications respond to political identities that are sometimes left out of games, such as in Medieval Total War, a whole mod community developed any number of other nations that were, like, not included by the canon of Medieval Total War, or alternatively, new media artists like Edo Stern sometimes use the game as a medium to mod, i.e. like, I believe he did a modification of Castle Wolfenstein where Israeli troops were able to shoot Nazis, thereby like, you know, somehow speaking through the medium to create political identities and situations that were not possible.
Right. I must say that I did not focus really on what people were modding. I mean, I just focused on the fact that they did and how they did it. I obviously did come across those kinds of examples, but I would not know any kind of percentage of or motivating factors for people doing that. But it happens a lot. I have seen it a lot. Yeah.
So I've done a couple of mods, and the last one, so a lot of this is totally resonates with my own personal experience, and the last mod I attempted in 2006, I think fell apart because it hit that other side of the U-shaped curve. It was interesting while we were still successful that there was a team, and that we were that all these different expertises were necessary, and that there were some expertises that were really, really hard to come by, like being able to do animation is a very rare expertise, not just because it's a specific skill, but also the software you need to be able to do it is thousands of dollars, so you either have to be rich or somebody with student discounts. And so there was a very, very slight group of people who can actually help you with that. And then eventually I had to stop because I either had to quit my job or actually manage this mod. It turned out it's one of those full-time things. And, you know, but putting aside the management part, which I think is crucial, it struck me as you're talking about this, the difference between modding as evolution versus revolution is that if you want to have a really active mod community, it seems like you have to hold the technology steady for a very long period of time so that $1,000 animation software eventually becomes $100 or even free so that more people can actually use it. But then the business of the company creating that entire framework is to revolutionize their software so that more people will buy it. So there's always this tension between a community that wants to mod and being able to hold the platform steady enough for that to be accessible to a larger group of people.
Yes, that's a very good point. And that's, I guess, that's one of the difficulties with this type of research anyway, because you always look at, on the one hand, the firm perspective, and then you look at the community perspective, and then to see where they match and where they overlap or how they're organized. So you kind of try to mirror lots of things and to see where things work or don't work. And this is definitely one of those things. But in a way, the community is actually right now always disadvantaged in any regard, because especially because of the money that they don't have. Most of the times.
I mean, if you move it up a level of abstraction, the conflict right now between PCs and consoles, for a while it looked like consoles were winning because they did keep that platform steady. If you think of the developers, the commercial developers, as the modders and the people who create the consoles,
right,
as kind of an analogous situation, you know, the PlayStation 2 stayed steady for years and years and years, and then you had a lot of companies be able to iterate on that. I don't know if that kind of works out as an analogy to kind of users being the companies themselves.
Yeah, because you see that now also with the Xbox, there's now a few games actually that you can mod on your Xbox, where you can get in even more complicated situations. Yeah. Yes. Cool. Yeah.
Someone who ended up on that right side of the U-shaped curve, right? Someone who found themselves actually building a team and talking about that question of whether you quit your job or not. What was your motivation for building a mod of this complexity?
Right. Naivete? No, I mean, like, it actually was, as Zach was raising, I actually wanted to kind of reimagine a previous game in that series, which had a kind of ecological perspective to it, and I wanted to kind of recapture that ecological perspective in this mod. So there was both the kind of being able to recreate an experience that it already had. So in some sense, it was already derivative in many ways. But then also be able to put into it a particular kind of message that wasn't in this most recent version of that same kind of lineage of games. And this was a Civilization series of games.
Anybody else? All right, then, I would say thank you very much for all coming.